Change the wall.
All right, good afternoon, folks. Sorry for the delayed start to this meeting. It's my intention that we'll continue the meeting until 4 o'clock. We have use of the room until 4. So with that, we'll call the meeting, this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is now, 3 minutes after 2 on Wednesday, February 29th, 2012. Let the record reflect the following members are present. Representative Gardner, Representative Dick, Representative Heron, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear two new bills, House Joint Resolution 32 to remove wood bison from the endangered list by Representative Alan Dick, and House Bill 328, Oil and Gas Corporate Taxes by Representative Paul Seaton. Okay, on House Joint Resolution 32, let's see, Representative Dick, are you going to present them?
Well, sit side by side.
Okay. Okay, there are two, you guys have two CSs in the packet. I assume version E is the one we want to work with?
Yes.
Okay. Also online, we have Doug Vincent Lang from the Department of Fish and Game, and I understand he'll be available until 2:30 is all. All right. Representative Dick, you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Feige, and to the whole committee here. Last year we heard, for the record, Representative Alan Dick. Last year we heard HB 186, and I appreciated the time of that the committee at that time. And I really do believe that as this has worked its way through the process and many conversations, I believe this year we do have perhaps what was the ultimate answer for both the state and the bison. I think we're all going to end up happy if as this passes. I really believe the people that are going to benefit the most is the people of the Yukon. There's a lot of groups of people that are concerned about the bison, individuals and groups, both within the state and even within the nation. And our concern is all along has not been with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game or the Federal Fish and Wildlife, but it is just our main concern has been with the potential for some special interest group and a federal judge 5,000 miles away slamming the gavel and altering our lives permanently. And you'll probably see on your on the desk in front of you the letter of support from Craig Fleener from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Appreciate your time and attention. My staff, Paul Verhagen, will give a brief presentation and be very interested in your comments.
Okay, we've been joined, let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. Mr. Verhagen.
For the record, I'm Paul Verhagen. I'm a legislative aide for Representative Dick. Last year, Representative Dick filed HB 186 in an effort to prevent the Alaska Department of Fish and Game from introducing wood bison into the state without approval by the legislature. But between then and now, interesting things have happened with regard to the Endangered Species Act.
Heavy.
After several states spent years working to get gray wolves removed from the list, they found themselves extremely frustrated when one court would rule in their favor and another would rule against them. Eventually, they took their case to Congress. In a surprise move, Congress intervened and exempted the gray wolf from the Endangered Species Act and made their decision not subject to review by the courts. From Representative Dick's perspective, a similar action by Congress would remove all of our problems, as you just heard him state, regarding it would allow the bison to be released into the wild without the restrictions that come along with the act, and they could be managed by our State Department of Fish and Game, just as the plains bison have been successfully managed for 70 years. In an effort to urge Congress to intervene on our behalf, Representative Dick is seeking this joint House resolution that encourages Congress to exempt wood bison from the act. Representative Dick recently received a letter from Jeff Haskett, the Regional Director of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. He takes issue with some of the statements that Representative Dick has made in the resolution. But Representative Dick doesn't question that Fish and Wildlife Service has spent years working with the Department of Fish and Game in an effort to reintroduce wood bison, and he doesn't question that Fish and Wildlife Service wants the project to move forward, nor does he question their diligence in ensuring that the agreements that they reach with Fish and Game complies with the most current interpretation of the Endangered Species Act. In fact, he sympathizes with the service as they try to keep up with the rulings because the ink is barely dry on the last ruling before the next ruling is out. Fish and Wildlife Service is constantly chasing a moving target, and the situation is only getting worse, and that's the point that Representative Dick is making. The act was created, obviously, with the best of intentions by people with sincere concern for the environment, but over the years, as groups have become involved, special interest groups have become involved, it's caused a situation where competing interests are resulting in various judges from around the state issuing rulings that are contradictory to one another, and it has bogged things down to the point that it appears right now that the biggest obstacle to the wood bison success in Alaska is the Endangered Species Act itself. If they were to be treated the same as the wood bison, that the plains wood bison, plains bison, they'd be wandering the landscape, and we wouldn't have to worry about locked up resources. Although passage of this resolution won't change anything itself, it will serve to remind Congress again that in more than a few instances, the act itself has become its own worst enemy. It may also prompt them to step in and resolve our wood bison problem. If they were to also exempt all bison, including the plains bison, then we wouldn't need to worry about recent lawsuits that have been filed to include plains bison under the protection of the act. I have other information that I was going to include, but I think that that with the information that Representative Dick has given you and the prior testimony, that I'll just wait and at this point and see if there's anything else. So this concludes my testimony.
And Representative Seed, a motion to adopt version.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that we adopt version E, CS for House Joint Resolution 32 for discussion.
And hearing no objections, we will adopt version E as the working document. We've also been joined by Representative Foster. And I'd like to get, we've got Mike Miller online with the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center. But before we get to him, any questions for Mr. Verhagen? Representative Wilson, then Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, while we were waiting for the federal government to get all their regulations and everything in order, how much is it costing us a year to keep these 102 bison corralled somewhere and to feed and take care of?
It's my understanding it's $100,000 a year. Recently, Fish and Wildlife Services granted the state $200,000. To take care of what they said was a year. So I'm not sure if that was a mistake. It was really 2 years' worth, and the price has gone up by $100,000, but it was $100,000 a year.
Okay, thank you.
And if I, Representative Alan Dick here, if I could respond to that as well, Representative Wilson, I know the Department of Fish and Game and the DNR are working together. They're both quite aware of the situation and the hazards and the desire to get the bison out on the landscape. And so there's been a very intense conversation going on, looking for an island somewhere, maybe out of Kodiak or somewhere, where they could be put temporarily, and so they could be roaming and not costing the state any money at all, while you know, we can get Congress to make sure that to get them off the Endangered Species Act, so that when we put them out there, that everybody's a winner. So that conversation is going on. The two commissioners have both been working very diligently on that.
Thank you,
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. You made reference to a letter from Mr. Haskett, and is that in our packets?
I believe it is.
Oh.
Isn't? Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might.
Brief it is. On the record, while Ms. Hay makes copies, Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if some of the changes in the version E were in response to that letter.
Through the chairman, actually, the changes that were made preceded my receiving a copy of the letter.
Okay.
However, some of the things that were changed were things that were in the letter.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Munoz. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks. Thank you, Representative, for the presentation. Can you, and maybe this would be more directed to Fish and Game, but can you tell me what the status is of the 10J exclusion for non-experimental populations and where we are with that status? Because that seemed to be the way out. And I know we've been talking about this for several years. But
That 10J exemption is still, I believe, is still being applied for. But the real question was the 4D exemption that spoke to whether the animals can actually be hunted once they're reintroduced. And the state of Alaska said that they will not reintroduce the animals if they can't be hunted at some point. And so it was really the 4D exemption was the one that there was really a stalemate between the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the federal Fish and Wildlife. And the state said they will not reintroduce the animals if there is not the potential for their being hunted at some point in time.
And so,
follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
And so, in what process are we in currently with Fish and Wildlife Services and the state in negotiating the hunting portion?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, it's my understanding that that they've gotten approval from the service director on the hunting aspect of it. So that looks like that's moved forward. The other exemption, though, is where they're still working on the 10J portion of it. And I don't know. That'd be a question that Fish and Game would be able to answer.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee for Mr. Verhagen and Representative Dick? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm kind of wondering if there are any examples in which an endangered species was removed from the list by region. Does that ever happen where, say, something's endangered in one area but in another area is not?
Now, through the chair, yes, that's the only thing that's ever happened one time was the gray wolf was removed by Congress, and it pertained to the Idaho and Montana area was where they were removed while others were left on the list. And I'm not sure if that's changed since I last knew that, but that was one example of it.
Thank you. So, if I might, Mr. Chair, have you explored the possibility of asking that the wood bison be removed from an endangered species list in Alaska only?
To the Chair, Representative Gardner, Representative Allen Dick here. Since the only wood bison in the United States are in Alaska, that thought never crossed my mind.
Moot point. Thank you.
There you go. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Online, we have Mr. Mike Miller from the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Miller, with your testimony. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm glad I was invited to talk today. I appreciate the work of Representative Allen Dick. I mean, I know he's concerned about this, and he seems like he's working towards some good can-do options. With his regards to this bill where he's talking about removing them as a congressional act, Eddie Grasser is working on that right now. I think he met probably 3 weeks ago with both Senator Murkowski and Representative Don Young to talk about this, and they were going to attach something to the U.S. budget where if the budget passed, this got included also. And I know they feel optimistic about doing this, and it would be the best thing for everybody concerned with the wood bison if it did go that way. With the 10J rule, I think the answers to that, some of your questions that you just had, could be better answered by Doug Vincent Lang, because what Representative Dick was saying about the 4D was true, but they've worked through that, and both sides are trying to come up with agreeable language, but it's like Representative Dick said, they're just not right there yet. But it would be good to proceed both with the 10J rule and the complete congressional downlist delisting at the same time. It, as far as taking care of the animals here, I'm Mike Miller with the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center. I'm staring at 102 wood bison out in my backyard right now. So I just wanted to give you some background on who I am. I manage the animals for the state of Alaska. And the expense isn't really all that monumental. Carlisle Transportation does all the hauling of 1,000 bales of hay from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Palmer down to here, and we have it pretty much down to a minimum to take care of these animals. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Forest Service, has given us land to put the bison on, a 15-year lease just for wood bison, and we could continue to expand that leasing area because we do have, we'll have 40 calves this spring. But to wrap up, I would just encourage everybody to continue a can-do attitude. These animals right now are on the endangered species list. They can't go back to Canada. They can't be slaughtered. They can't be sold. And we do have them, and the best option is we're sort of forced to find a good end result for this because they're living, breathing things that are going to continue to live and breathe, and they're going to outlive all of us. And we're forced to find a good solution. But again, when we talk about Canada, because Canadian has theirs down to threatened, and they have 6,000 animals, 6,000 to 8,000 animals now, they do have resource development with their oil sands and everything, and with the wood bison there, it's all compatible. And it would be a great thing for this legislation session if we could come to some sort of resolution on this, because it would be a great thing for the state of Alaska, just not for the hunting opportunities, but for the tourism opportunities and for the fact that we did have an animal that became extinct like the muskox and returned it to the landscape like we should. But if anybody has any questions for me, I'm ready to answer them.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Miller? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Miller, what is the normal lifespan of wood bison?
A wood bison in the wild, because it goes through hardships. And like I said previously, we have 1,000 of those round bales, and we feed a little bit of grain and all that stuff. They have it pretty easy here. It's like being at Alyeska Resort. And in the wild, they'll live. An old bison will be 16 years old, but in captivity, they'll live up to 60, and they'll calve into their 40s, and they can produce a calf every year instead of every other year like in the wild. They really expand their lifespan when in captivity.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Also, with putting them on an island, I know Representative Dick mentioned that, but that's just a Band-Aid, and the problem's not going to go away. Island would only be a short-term thing, and like I would sort of like to discourage that, because if there is cost to the state, we have, it's an easily fundable thing for the $100,000 a year. I can find foundations that'll support that, so there's no expense to the state.
Any other questions for Mr. Miller?
Thank you.
Representative Dick?
Yes, I'd like to comment on the island idea. The Department of Fish and Game is having a hard time finding an island that doesn't already have cattle, except one that is way out in the Aleutians, and I think the cost estimate was like $800,000 to move them out there, and of course they'd have to move back again. So that just, it's bad math. Additionally, but the whole idea was that we really do want to do what's best for the bison, and if I were one of them, I'd want to be free roaming. I wouldn't want to be down portage with in a pen, but that the math has been done on that issue.
Put them on Douglas.
Any other questions? Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? Anybody else online? Okay, at this time we'll close public testimony on House Joint Resolution 32. And the chair will entertain any amendments. Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to propose amendment number one, I believe it would be, which would be to remove the whereas on page one, lines 8 through 10.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that, you know, we've seen the U.S. Department of Interior's letter, and in the third paragraph, they directly contradict that whereas or disagree with that. I don't think that this whereas is necessary at all for the flow of the and the accomplishing the goals of the resolution, so I would offer that hopefully as a friendly amendment.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dick?
I appreciate that friendly amendment. A lot of my best editing is with my delete key, so I have no problem with the amendment whatsoever.
Representative Wilson?
No.
At this point, I'll remove my objection. And the line 8 to line 10 on page 1 is deleted. Any other amendments from the committee? Representative Wilson?
I would just like for us to look at this letter that was just handed out to us.
Okay.
And on the second page, on the second paragraph, it says the statements claiming that if wood bison were released to the state, in their habitat could become subject to the restrictive provisions. That's on of the resolution on page 2. That's on lines 22 to 25. And then going back to what his comments were in this letter, it says these exaggerated statements about ESA are creating a negative and fearful environment that makes it more difficult to achieve common ground as they're trying to work toward some kind of agreement here. And so I'm wondering if we should think about taking that out. I don't know. I'm just calling that to the committee's attention right now.
Discussion? I think it depends on your point of view on the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
Representative Kasagi?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we get maybe staff or somebody from Fish and Game to respond to that?
We've got Doug Vincent laying online. He's from Division of Wildlife.
Could you please repeat that question exactly?
Representative Wilson.
Do you have that letter from the United States Department of Interior from...
I have read it. I don't have it in front of me, but I've read it.
Okay. Well, on the second page, in the second paragraph, I'll read... it says, the statements claiming that if wood bison were released in the state, their habitat could become subject to the restrictive provisions of the ESA and result in exorbitant economic costs are unfounded. These exaggerated statements about the ESA are creating a negative and fearful environment that makes it more difficult to achieve common ground. The service is working with the state to designate the Alaska population of wood bison as a non-essential experimental population with the associated state management plan. And I'm just asking the question, if that is causing some problems moving along, should we delete that part of the resolution or not? I'm just asking the question because it was in that letter.
Okay, through the chair, maybe I can just give you a little bit of background from the state's perspective on wood bison. First off, the state is working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the exact rules that you've been discussing, the 10J rule, and a rule that would essentially designate these animals as non-essential experimental. And I think we are fairly close to reaching some type of agreement with the service that those rules provide sufficient language to assure that those animals are not affecting resource development across the state. That said, however, there are things that are happening on the broader national scale that concern us about the certainty of those rules being able to withstand legal scrutiny, especially if those
challenges to those rules are filed in case in courts outside of Alaska, and which are ultimately defended by the Department of Justice, and for which the state of Alaska may not be a party in the settlement of those lawsuits. So I think, you know, the service is right. All intent is to not have, is to use these rules to try to prevent those kinds of undue restrictions on designation of critical habitat or on jeopardy findings on species that are out in the landscape. But in getting to a rule that assures that certainty will go a long ways towards that end. But that's only part of the question that the state will have to answer after that rule is published. And we'll have to, again, very closely look at how valid those rules are or how firm those rules will be in terms of withstanding judicial scrutiny, especially if those suits are filed outside of Alaska. And perhaps, too, more importantly, there's some recent evidence that some of these rules may be renegotiated by the services to the states that have released non-essential experimental populations in their landscape. So, again, we're working towards those rules with the hope that those rules will provide the certainty we need to assure ourselves that we're not in the same position with sea otters we are currently today on the landscape. That is, we introduce a species and then we are now left with you know, the uncertainty of how to manage those into the future. So clearly, from our point of view, the most certainty we can have before we proceed with release of these on the landscape is to have an exemption for the species under the Endangered Species Act, similar to what was done with gray wolves in the Montana and Idaho regions, very similar because of judicial challenges to those ESA listings. And in those cases, the service was very much in agreement with the states as to the need to delist those wolves. It was just simply the judicial system that prevented it from happening.
Representative Wilson?
That was a long-winded answer to the question, but I think the there is a certain amount of fear out there that regarding the certainty of those rules and regarding, you know, what would happen if in fact those rules were overturned sometime in the future.
So do you feel like that whereas needs to stay in there or that it should come out?
Well, I guess what I'm telling you is that whereas is reflecting what I'm hearing at my desk, fear out on the landscape regarding the certainty of those rules and what could happen if those were overturned.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you list some examples of ESA-listed animals that have been introduced into the wild as non-essential experimental?
We've had wolves in the lower 48 listed. We've also had grizzly bears listed. I mean introduced in the landscape. We've had some falcons introduced on the landscape. There's a couple more, but those are the three that immediately come to my mind.
So could you?
And we're also having trouble now. The state of Wyoming is having trouble now with grizzly bears that were reintroduced under non-essential experimental populations also.
But could you go into more detail what non-essential experimental means, please?
Okay. When the Endangered Species Act was first passed by Congress, it didn't have a provision for non-essential experimental populations. And as such, when the Fish and Wildlife Service and states were trying to reintroduce species onto the landscape, they were put, the only way they could be put onto the landscape was under the full protection of the Endangered Species Act. And that resulted in immediately that carryover of that designation as well as a designation of critical habitat. So it became very difficult for states or the federal agencies to go to federal private landowners, a variety of other people, to say, let's reintroduce these animals on the landscape because immediately critical habitat was designated. So Congress amended the act, I think it was in 1980 or 1990, I can't remember the exact year, but they basically put a provision in the act saying that there's an opportunity to designate animals that are trying to be reintroduced into the landscape as non-essential experimental to that species. And as such, you could write special rules that were associated with that species that would disallow the designation of critical habitat and allow taking of that species where that otherwise wouldn't be allowed under existing Endangered Species Act statutes. So it was basically a way to say that if you brought these animals onto the landscape, you could deal with them differently than under the endangered. They would still be categorized under the Endangered Species Act, but they would be fundamentally treated differently in terms of how they were regulated under the Act.
Okay, and that agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been negotiated to allow that designation for these animals?
We are working with them towards that end to get a non-essential experimental population designation and the associated regulations regarding what is an allowable take for those wood bison on the landscape. And the allowable takes would be any take that's associated with a resource development activity, or a allowed take would be hunting. And again, as I said earlier, that's one step in this process that would help us get towards the end. But again, we would need to be assured before we put animals in the landscape under that rule that that rule would withstand judicial scrutiny if it was especially filed out of the state of Alaska.
Okay, so it sounds like it's the department's intent to get that clarified and confirmed before any animals are introduced.
Yeah, we have told the legislation, we've also told the public that we will not introduce wood bison out into the landscape until everyone is convinced that there is certainty to the rules and that those rules would be defendable.
Thank you.
But again, none of that would be necessary if, in fact, Representative Dick's motion here and Congress were to exempt these animals from the Endangered Species Act. And again, that would be, from my point of view, conservation success here is getting these animals out on the landscape. And clearly right now the biggest reason they're not getting out in the landscape is fear associated with the uncertainty of how the Endangered Species Act will be implemented. And if we can remove that fear associated with that uncertainty of how the act could be used, or the judicial scrutiny of that act could be applied to that, to how that rule will be subsequently implemented, I think we would go a long way towards getting these bison out in the landscape quickly.
And Ms. Lang, just a question on the grizzly bears that were introduced as a non-essential species. Are they allowed to be hunted?
In some cases, yes. But again, there's some of the problems we're having with some of these species in the lower 48 that were not essential experimental is there were also wild animals that were out on the landscape. So as those animals are mixing with the non-essential experimental animals, it becomes a very complex question. So fortunately, we don't have that issue in Alaska right now.
Okay. Representative Dick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to point out, too, that the target of this resolution is not the Federal Fish and Wildlife, and I'm sorry if somebody at Federal Fish and Wildlife is offended, but the real target audience is the United States Congress, who sometimes has a hard time to hear what we're saying from here in Alaska. So the intent here was to build in a little sense of frustration so that Congressman Young could go to his colleagues and say, listen, this is the level of frustration that our people are experiencing. So again, I'm sorry if somebody at Fish and Wildlife is offended, but we need to be firm enough to make our point clear and not so firm that we're offensive and confrontive. But I think if our target audience here is the United States Congress, I'm not sure we can be firm enough. I don't think we can be adamant enough. That's a concern. I would like to mention that I think I wrote down the exorbitant financial claims, but we do need to remember that Donlin Creek has $100 billion worth of gold, and Donlin Creek is only 50 miles away from where the mouth of the Innoko, where they were talking about introducing these bison. And I think maybe the most poignant statement here is on page 3, lines 10 to 12. I think this really sums it up. It says, whereas these facts serve to demonstrate this point, the wood bison status on the list of species protected under the Endangered Species Act of 1973 is what most endangers them. I think that says everything. That if we could put them on the landscape and they could roam free, they would be able to multiply. But the fact that they are on the Endangered Species Act makes them endangered because we're afraid to put them out there. That's the point. So again, I'd just like to say that what we're really trying to do here is give Congressman Young some ammunition, give him some bullets, give him a sense of what's going on here in Alaska. We're certainly in this room and probably in this building. We're all in agreement. Fish and Game, we're in agreement. And I apologize if somebody from Federal Fish and Wildlife is offended, but that person wasn't the target audience.
Any further questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move CS for House Joint Resolution 32, Version E, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and to be a fiscal note. Yeah, and a zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objections. CS for House Joint Resolution number 32, as amended with the attached zero fiscal note, is moved out of committee. You can brief that easily. Sign the paperwork. Come back into order. Next up, we have House Bill 328. It'll be presented by Representative Seaton, and his aide Louis Flora will run the PowerPoint for some of the packet materials. Online, we have Robin Wilson from the Department of Revenue, and Joanna Bales, also Department of Revenue, and Deborah. Is it Vogt, V-O-G-T, as an invited expert witness. She is a former deputy commissioner in the Department of Revenue in the early 1980s, and she'll be testifying. So with that, Representative Seaton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. House Bill 328 reinstates the oil and gas corporate income tax regime that was Alaska law from 1978 through 1981. It requires oil companies to pay their corporate income tax on the profits made in Alaska. This is generally referred to as separate accounting. You know, one way we can look at it, it's a matter of equity. Alaska only oil companies pay their corporate income tax on Alaska profits. International oil companies, unlike our small businesses, do not have the advantage of writing off investments in other countries against their corporate income tax in Alaska. House Bill 328 simply treats international oil companies like other oil companies in Alaska. Separate accounting was instituted in 1975. In 78 it actually went into effect. And that was brought into the case because Alaska did not feel that it was getting the proper amount of its corporate income tax, which was 9.4%, and it wasn't being paid on the profits made from Alaska. That was challenged in the 80s, and it was upheld in the lower courts and appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court, where it was upheld on all grounds. That was then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, unlike the usual case of just not taking a case, they actually took it, dismissed it, saying that there was no federal constitutional or federal statutory problems with it, or there was no questions to be resolved by them. And courts have determined that separate accounting falls within the state's legitimate taxing authority. When we were over on our Norway tour, one of the things we specifically asked after they were telling us about their tax regime was, well, do you do separate accounting? I mean, do they pay on their profits only in Norway? And the answer was yes. Most regimes around the world do that. There have been some questions about other states. Some other states actually have two different sections of corporate income tax. They have their regular corporate income tax if you do separate accounting, paying on your profits in that jurisdiction. However, if you want to use water's edge, is what it's called, in other words, all the way, any profits made in the and expenses in the United States, then you pay an additional amount that is more than 50% increase in the taxes. So this is done in multiple other jurisdictions. So, you know, when we develop PPT, Petroleum Profits Tax, and then later ACEs, it was critical to not have ring fencing. And ring fencing is the idea that if you go into a new area and have expenditures, then you would have to write those expenditures off against the profits that are made in that area. We didn't want to do that because we wanted to stimulate investment in a broad scope across Alaska. And so it was specifically not put in there to stimulate that outside or that expansion of investment. However, when we get to our current tax rate, which is worldwide apportionment, that's exactly what it does. It says you can take and invest in other places, and if those aren't as profitable, you know, the way it all works is you reduce your corporate income taxes to Alaska and because of your other investments that we're stimulating overseas. So anyway, those are basically some of the reasons why we need to go back to separate accounting. Give a little history here. This is just the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska, and this was one of the third pages where they looked at how much was the loss, and it's about, as you can see on that bottom line, $1.8 billion in those 4 years. However, we've just gotten some of this information out of the archives, and although it was a $1.8 billion liability, which is what the previous legislature was looking at the time. We didn't have the value in a permanent fund and those things that we have now. So the legislature said, well, we're getting so much liability here, we're going to go back to worldwide apportionment until the court clears things up. And they did clear that up. And but you can see it was $1.8 billion in those 4 years that we collected more than we would have under the worldwide apportionment regime. However, about $400,000, about $400 million of that was interest on those years. So it's really about $1.4 billion or $350 million. So if we look at other comparisons that are made, this is by Daniel Dickinson, who was with the Deputy Commissioner DOR. And in 2000, he brought forward this calculations to House Oil and Gas Special Committee on Oil and Gas. And you can see on the left-hand column, of course, are the years, and you can see the actual oil and gas income tax that was collected. That was under worldwide apportionment down that column. The next one column is the estimated separate accounting revenue, and you can see the difference. And so when you add those differences up, you see it's $4.65 billion dollars that we did not collect. And that equals about $291 million a year that we did not collect under separate accounting. This is graphically the way it was displayed to the Oil and Gas Committee, and you can see on the left-hand side of each one of those bars is what was collected under separate accounting, what was collected under worldwide apportionment. And the taller bars are what the 9.4% of Alaska income would have been if they had done under separate accounting. And you know there's a relationship that changes because there's different amounts of investments, different expenses in different years and different prices. But you can see under each case, our 9.4% taxation on money that was earned in Alaska is higher than any of the other cases. In the fiscal note that you have the fiscal note, and in the middle of that fiscal note, it's a little hard to read. So I'll just read under revenues. It says that second sentence, preliminary estimates show that under separate accounting, oil and gas corporations would have paid approximately $250 million more during each of the last five fiscal years in corporate income tax if this legislation had been in effect. So we are seeing from that's the analysis from the current bill, and that's a fairly high-level calculation that's being made, and I'm sure that Department of Revenue will explain that as we go. But we have three different determinations. We have the determination when we had separate accounting in effect, 75 through 81. We have the estimates from Dan Dickinson from 2000, and we have now the estimate from the Department of Revenue, all being in somewhat the same range, you know, $200 million to $390 million per year, and variable around that, so it's not a set amount. So here is ConocoPhillips' net income in the United States from production. And the reason that these are here with ConocoPhillips, good company, but it's just that they do file SEC filings. So the legislative research was able to go back and take their 10-Ks, which are their required SEC filings, and give the proportion of U.S. exploration and production in income versus that in the other states in the United States. And so you can see it's variable. Some years it's more and some years it's less. And then here's basically worldwide apportionment. And again, you can see that Alaska down there in the blue represents a significant amount, but it is quite variable depending upon what's happening in other parts of the world. And separate accounting says that we're not going to consider what's happening in other parts of the world, that the corporate income tax would be paid on the taxes made or the profit made in Alaska.
What happened in 2009?
Economic problem.
But you mean for the lower 48, they had no, they reported no profits in the lower 48. This was a Petroleum News article. You've got the full article in your packet, and it was Greg Garland. This was from May of 2011, where they were talking about Eagles Ford from ConocoPhillips. Greg Garland was Senior Vice President for Exploration and Production in the Americas. And this is a quote that you see. Garland said the play, which is Eagles Ford, offered 45 per barrel margins last year, twice the average of Conoco's global portfolio. So we can see then what their average of their global portfolio is, in somewhere in the $20 to $25 range. And yet, if you look at the economics for Alaska, spring 2011, you know, we had $118 a barrel. You take off transportation, you take off royalty, you take off upstream costs, and you take off the production tax value, you find that the Alaska margin is $43.50. Well, in actuality, it's more than that, because from a few weeks ago in publication we all get, I'm trying to remember what it is right now.
Petroleum News?
Not the Petroleum News.
What was the?
Well, anyway, ConocoPhillips, chief economist, came out and said that their cost of producing a barrel in oil is $15.48. So you'd have to add another $4 and some to the margin here. But still, we're well above the worldwide margin. So what's happening is we're diluting our margin here for worldwide production that is less profitable. And so anyway, that was what we wanted to show at this point in time, because I don't think it's the I thought we had one other graph. I think you've got it in your packet where it shows competitiveness. We've all been talking about worldwide competitiveness, and Pedro Van Meer's had one of the competitiveness charts, but those are based on not what oil companies are paying, but what the tax rate is. So if we are putting in 35% federal tax and 9.4% state tax, the government take appears to be higher, and if we're not actually receiving that because of worldwide apportionment, that means our take, the total government take, is less, and we are actually more competitive than would show up as in those tables, because they're assuming that we're actually getting the 9.4%, and as all three analyses show, we're not getting the 9.4% of the Alaska profit revenue made in Alaska were getting somewhat less, and those were those three tables that were given somewhere between $250 and $350 million a year. So we do have, Mr. Chairman, Deborah Vogt online, and she actually was with DOR Legal when they submitted the separate accounting Atlantic Richfield versus State of Alaska Supreme Court decision to the Supreme Court in the state, and so she is much more clear and vocal, I'm sure, than I am on how that works. I would just like also say there was a couple other things. When we had Pedro Van Meers was directly asked the question in both the presentation he made to all the legislature up in Anchorage and also at a committee meeting here, definitely thinks that Alaska should have separate accounting as the way we do our corporate income tax. And so with that, just see if there's any questions for me or we can go to the witnesses.
Okay. First we'll do questions to Representative Seaton, and if I could have you go back to, I think it's your page 8.
Yes.
You're essentially arguing that Alaska's profit margins per barrel, or as far as ConocoPhillips is concerned, are essentially the same in Texas and in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, they are, according to Greg Garland, the margin. And remember that ConocoPhillips has testified a number of times that when they talk, they're very distinct between margin and profit. But what I was really comparing was that he's saying that it's twice their average global portfolio. And so if it's twice their global portfolio, then
second page, you're saying the Alaska margin is $43.50. On this one, you're saying $45. So essentially pretty close. But in the upper corner here, I see where in the part of the headline, it says ConocoPhillips plans to invest $2 billion in liquid-rich shale plays, which basically sounds like the Eagle Ford area. But they're only investing less than $1 billion in Alaska. So if the margins are the same, why is there unequal investment?
Well, and as I pointed out, I didn't bring those slides before. One of the problems is that we have a situational risk in Alaska. We have only one way to get the oil out of here, and it's a long ways to go, and many things can happen. And so there's no mitigation of that single pipeline, you know, the stick of licorice. And ConocoPhillips is currently getting 63% of their profits out of, you know, we had that slide here, I believe it was. They're getting a very high percentage of their profits. Well, that's the income, not the profits. We could go back to the profit slide. But anyway, they're getting about 63% of their profits, and it goes down a single pipeline. And if anything happens in that pipeline, they have no way to get it out. They'd have to shut in all their wells. They'd have to all that expense, as well as whatever they're going to have to do to thaw out a pipeline if it's in the winter. And they don't even have any tested plan for thawing out an 800-mile stick of licorice or a candle. And so there's a situational risk, and so, you know, one of the things is that they have been pretty much flat in investing since 1996 as far as the number of wells they drill on the North Slope, even though tax rates have been totally different and even though prices have been totally different. So we're looking at some risk factors that they can't mitigate, and the question is, would the corporate board look at that as a fiduciary responsibility if they further concentrated their profits for it coming from Alaska? I mean, you had 100% of it in 2009. You had, you know, 60-some percent in 2010. 2011, you had 63.6% of their profits were from the North Slope in Alaska. So it's a concentration thing, and it doesn't relate to necessarily to profit margin, it's what's your exposure. If you went to 80 or 90% of your oil coming from that single source that had a big risk in the transportation portion of it, that might be why they are making that decision. But there's also another question on decisions, and that is that on the North Slope, there the operating agreement is that any one of the companies, any one of the three companies, if they choose not to invest, vetoes the project. So we don't know whether it is ConocoPhillips because of that risk, or it's one of the other two major players that would be not sanctioning an investment.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
I didn't have a question.
Oh, I thought you raised your hand earlier. Anybody else? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I saw that the figure 2 on where they're receiving $20 a barrel for getting oil out of the ground, and it's only costing $15.48. And I usually round numbers off, and I did at 600,000 barrels a day and a $4.52 discrepancy. I was looking for how we could fund education, and they come out to a little less than $1 billion, and I realized that I realized that of course some of that would be, you know, profit, and some of that would be theirs, and some of that would be ours. But that was a little less than $1 billion, and I guess what struck me was that education is being scrutinized almost to the point of hostility, and yet we have this here. Anyway, I saw $1 billion.
If you go back to your slide 9,
sure. Can I respond?
Sure.
And I want to make sure that everybody realizes this says typical company up here, because we've never been given the confidential material of who each company and what their production costs are. But Ms. Kahn, the chief economist for ConocoPhillips, last month released that publicly, because they gave it for here in different fields, that it was $15.48. So that's why I'm saying you'd add another $4.50 on here. Which slide did you want?
Slide 8.
8. Yes.
No. Bar graphs, go back further, I guess. The, probably, is it 6? Exploration and production income. Okay, that's the income.
This is the income. If you'd like them in percentages, we can pull those up.
Well, I guess my question is, how much oil does ConocoPhillips produce in Alaska versus how much oil does it produce in Texas? And what price does it get? Because at least for a long time here recently, West Texas Intermediate was down about $80 a barrel, while Alaska North Slope crude was above 100. So significant differences in quantity and price are going to influence those bar charts.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're exactly correct. And the question is, do we want things that are influencing in whether it's Iran or Australia or someplace else, or whether it's Texas, to influence the corporate income tax that's paid in Alaska, or do we want them to simply pay their 9.4% on the profits that are made in Alaska? The worldwide apportionment works both ways. It can make things go up and down because of what we have here, and you know, the argument can be made, well, maybe if we keep that, we can go grab profits that are made in Indonesia. The question is that all of the calculations that we have seen from when we had separate accounting, Dan Dickinson's 82 through 96, and then the fiscal note on this bill we just got yesterday, I believe, or 2 days ago, and all of those show that what's happening has been happening, although it varies a little bit, every single year we have been reducing our corporate income tax to basically subsidize operations in other parts of the world. And you know, no one's trying to do anything unfair. We're just trying to say, if our corporate income tax rate for Great Bear is going to be 9.4% of their income in Alaska, and they only have operations in Alaska, isn't it only just fair that BP or Conoco or Exxon pays their 9.4% on their income they make in Alaska? And the question of whether it's correct or not went all, not only through the trial court, but through the Alaska Supreme Court and through the United States Supreme Court. And it was determined at several points that separate accounting actually turned out to be much more accurately reflect the tax, corporate income tax, on the profits made in the jurisdiction, which is Alaska.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Munoz?
So using Conoco as an example, what is the real percentage that's paid, if you can, more or less, to Alaska?
It's very difficult because we don't have all of those informations. I mean, we have some, but it's all combined. So if we look back at the 10-Ks, we find that Conoco reported 1%, but that 1% wasn't a real 1%. That was 1% compared to their worldwide profit. So, and everything that we can get is that they lump all jurisdictions in the Americas together because they're having to do a U.S. United States report. So we can't say that the, and we don't know if when they file, let's say in North Dakota, if they have revenue through their Burlington acquisition there, that whether they're paying the 5.15, I think it is, percent, or they're doing Water's Edge, which adds another 3.5% corporate income tax if they do the Water's Edge. And of course, North Dakota has said, gee, we knows what happens if you allow apportionment, whether it's jurisdictional to the United States Water's Edge or if it was worldwide, what happens is you lose revenue because they don't pay on the full amount because they can wash it out with other expenses they have in other jurisdictions. So separate accounting simply does one thing and says you pay your corporate income tax on the profits you make in Alaska. We don't go and try and reach out into North Dakota or Indonesia or any place else that they have operations and try and take any profits from those areas. It's just simply pay your taxes on that. And I'm not saying that there's anything that any of the companies have done wrong. The state of Alaska creates the tax system. The people obey the tax system. If we allow no ring fencing around Alaska, if we take the same philosophy that we had when we did not ring fence the North Slope new fields, we said we want to make sure that you can take and write off those expenses that you have in those farther away fields against your Alaska income that was in production tax. But the same thing applies here, is if we, the further we draw the net, the more washout you can get. And that's all of the, each one of those three determinations has shown that we are losing income because we're getting less than 9.4%. But I can't tell you how much in any one year because that's confidential data and Department of Revenue can't tell us. We've gotten some aggregated data. We're happy that we were able to get a fiscal note that gave an estimate. And I think they've refined that estimate a little more, too, but they'll be testifying.
Just a couple of more, please.
Go ahead, Representative.
Do all of the majors use this worldwide accounting method?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, they use that where they're allowed to. Most jurisdictions don't allow it. And that's what was interesting about Norway. We have all the same players here that are working in Norway, and they all pay separate accounting in Norway, and that's what it is. And in most countries, they do that. It's only where they're allowed to use worldwide apportionment do they do it. And I don't blame them a bit. It's just that who are we as Alaska legislators here to work for and make sure that the correct amount of tax is paid? I mean, they are paying the correct amount of tax under the system we put in place. Mm-hmm. The question is that the appropriate system for Alaska, or should we go back to separate accounting? And just for a little more information, the bill, as we put it in here, reinstates the tax system as it's already gone through court and been approved all the way up through the Supreme Court. Doesn't have any federal issues, doesn't have any federal statutory or constitutional issues, doesn't have any Alaska Supreme Court issues, because that's what we've done. We've just gone back to the 78 accounting principles of separate accounting.
Any other questions for Representative Steve? Thank you. Representative Wilson?
As we're looking at this, and I'm just kind of thinking, and the governor has another bill, and the Senate has another bill floating around. Would we keep the bill, like the bill that we sent out of here last year, and that also? And so the one bill brings some things down and evens it out a little bit, and so that the curve isn't so steep. And then this would bring it up a little bit. And so overall, they probably would be paying maybe about the same as they're paying now, or is there any, their expenses, and they would consider this an expense.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think they're going to have to testify that. I think it does bring some balance, but really more than anything, what this does is say the appropriate tax should be paid in Alaska on the corporate income tax. The other bill deals with the production tax, which is different than corporate income tax, and I'm sure that the Department of Revenue will get into it and let us know how those are different. But basically, there's a difference in which we restrict what can be deducted for lease expenditures, but we allow instant write-off on those. And corporate income tax generally follows the depreciation rules of the federal income tax. And so there's a longer write-off period, but there are more things that can be written off than just direct lease expenditures. So all I can say is that we've had the Department of Revenue, we've got the experience when we had separate accounting. We had the Department of Revenue in 2000 do about a 10 or 15 year look back, and now we've got the fiscal note on this, and all are showing the same, is that we are not receiving the 9.4% of corporate income in the state of Alaska.
Okay, question on your on the fiscal note under the bill language paragraph. Looks like towards the end of line 4 on that first paragraph. And this is page 2 of 2 of the fiscal note.
I think we can go. See it very well there, but you're talking about where, Mr. Chairman?
The end of line 4.
Paragraph 1?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It says, this bill would require Alaska oil and gas corporations to calculate income tax for their oil and gas producing and transportation companies based on income earned solely in Alaska. The next sentence, if oil and gas companies are also engaged in activities other than oil and gas production and transportation, this bill would require those companies to calculate and pay tax on those other activities based on worldwide combination and apportionment. So I guess what I get from the fiscal note is that it seems like we're kind of picking and choosing where we're asking them to pay tax. Could you explain that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe we could ask Department of Revenue to weigh in on that.
Yeah, we can ask them. This is not unusual. Each time that I believe that the corporate income tax has been changed, and the same way it was before in 1978 through 81, was that if a corporation has land leasing or has buildings in Anchorage or would have something other than oil gas production, the taxes that we do now and worldwide apportionment deals with oil and gas, not their other activities. I mean, they could also own welding companies or other things that were, or retail stores. They could own many things. And so a lot of times integrated oil companies means that they have more than just oil and gas production. They may have refineries. Refineries are different, and they're treated different in 10Ks as well. So if you want to go to like ConocoPhillips 10K, you'll see that they list totally separate lines for their manufacturing and refining businesses than they do with oil and gas.
I understand. I guess, but your bill is wanting to essentially fence off Alaska. You know, the company's income-producing activities that are in Alaska. Why are we? Why in these? Simply because the company owns other things elsewhere. It seems like we're trying to tax those assets on a worldwide basis, which includes income as well as expenses. Why wouldn't you just keep it? I mean, the theme of the bill here is to kind of fence off Alaska and have it its own taxable entity. Why is it split like that?
Mr. Chairman, I think the Department of Revenue can more accurately reflect exactly why, but oil and
Joanna gas. Bales or Robin Wilson, do you have any comment on that?
This is Robin Wilson. Joanna Bales is in another hearing. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Corporate Income Tax Manager for the Tax Division. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could you repeat the question, and I'd be happy to respond as I can.
Okay, do you have a copy of the fiscal note in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, on page 2 of 2.
Yes.
Towards the end, on the first paragraph under bill language, we're looking at two sentences that start at the end of line 4.
Yes.
Okay, this bill would require Alaska Oil and Gas Corporations to calculate income tax for their oil and gas producing and transportation companies based on income earned solely in Alaska. And the next sentence says, if oil and gas companies are also engaged in activities other than oil and gas production transportation, the bill would require those companies to calculate and pay tax on those other activities based on worldwide combination and apportionment.
Yes.
Wouldn't that make the accounting rather complicated for all concerned?
Yes, it certainly may make the accounting complicated for sort of two reasons. One is that under the bill there's sort of three components that go together, and the component that you're referring to is the other business, shall we call it, and that's going to be on a basis under the Internal Revenue Code, whereas your other two components are on a different basis. So you may have intercompany transactions that would be difficult to account for. And the second thing is that one actual corporation, and by that I mean a separate legal entity as opposed to a corporate group, these operations may be mixed within the corporation's books. And so extracting the piece that is specifically production may be difficult as well.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. But is that exact thing done in other jurisdictions already by these same companies?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I am not currently aware of exactly how separate accounting works in Norway. Within the United States, in general, states either tax on a combination and apportionment, which is the system that we're under, or they may tax based on a separate company income. I can certainly follow up on that if we need to. But as for a separate, sort of a mixture, which this bill provides, I'm not aware of other jurisdictions that do it just this way.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've got a question I want to ask Joanna. Oh, no, it wasn't Joanna. Robin. And then also a different question I want to ask the sponsor. So, Robin, would it be easier for you and for the department, because I see here that you thought that you would need four additional corporate income tax auditors because of this. Would it be easier for the department if we took care of all of them on separate accounting? Would it be easier for you, yes or no?
If everything was, through the chair, Representative Wilson, if it was everything was on separate accounting, you would still have the difficulties of intercompany transactions, and also where a company had multiple activities within its corporate structure, within its set of books, you still have the problem of extracting that separate operation, if you will. In addition, there's the administrative provisions in the bill as to when the return is due and the part about that the department must calculate the taxable income and the tax and provide an assessment within, I think, 4 months, and then also has auditing responsibilities, presumably on top of that, based under Chapter 5, that would go on after that. Add that to the responsibility of the public disclosure provisions that are added in here. And although it may simplify it slightly, I don't think it's going to simplify it materially.
Okay. Thank you. And what I wanted to ask the sponsor was, you wanted to keep it exactly like the way it was before because of the courts have already said it was okay to do it that way.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's exactly correct. And also, you know, regs were already written for doing separate accounting under this exact same proposal. So I think that writing regs would be much simpler because they're already written that work to put this into effect for 4 years. Okay. So we can check with other people. I'm not sure how significant the oil and gas corporations are mixed with. I mean, I don't think any of them own Walmart or Costco or anything, but that would be the kind of thing that would be a non-oil and gas, you know, related income. They may have operations that are not oil and gas producing, but this was the way it was written. The regs were written on it. This is the way it was worked through. So that's the advice of our legal counsel, Ledge Legal, was this has already been solved. We don't have to worry nearly so much about any kind of lawsuits or anything else. If we go making changes, then we run into the question of, oh, is this a totally different structure that requires new lawsuits and other things?
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for the sponsor? At this time, we'll open up public testimony and go to Deborah. Is it Vogt, V-O-G-T, in Haines? If you would, please state your name for the record.
Am I coming through okay?
Yes, ma'am. I'm coming through just fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Vogt, and by way of introduction, I joined the Department of Law, the Attorney General's Office, in 1978, and retired from the Department of Revenue. Retired from the Department of Revenue in 1999 when I was serving as Deputy Commissioner. So I've been out of this business for 10 years, and the law that we're talking about was repealed more than 30 years ago. A lot has changed at times, so forgive me if the cobwebs are a little bit thick. 1978 was the year that the oil started flowing. It was the year that separate accounting was enacted. It was the time when the value of a barrel of oil was about $8. And it was not long after that time that the oil industry sued over the separate accounting law. I had the defending that law in front of the state Supreme Court and before the United States Supreme Court, so I can speak with some fluency on it. And I thought I would chat today in a pretty simplistic manner about the law that was on the books before separate accounting, about the separate accounting law, and about the law that we have now. All of these are methods of dividing the income of a multi-jurisdictional taxpayer. They're a way of dividing up the pie so that each taxing jurisdiction knows how much of the overall pie it can attribute to its state for tax purposes. The analogy that I like to use is that it's kind of like restaurant accounting. If you go to dinner with five of your friends and the bill comes in $300, you can divide it up two ways. You can say, well, there's six of us, and we'll just divide the whole bill by six, or you can sit down and figure out what each person ate and how much that entree cost. The first one is formula apportionment, and the second one is separate accounting. They are two means to the same end, and that is determining what the appropriate share is for, in the case of diners, one person, or in the case of taxpayers, one jurisdiction. Alaska was, I think, the first state to adopt the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, UDITPA, which is the three-factor formula that's most commonly used and which today we use for almost all corporate taxpayers. It is encoded in the law as AS 4319, and it's the method of attribution for the tax under 4320. The formula is the standard three-factor formula, which includes payroll, property, and sales. And so the amount of income that a taxpayer earns is attributed to the state by averaging the fraction of that taxpayer's property that is in the state and the sales that are in the state and the payroll that is in the state as compared to, in the case of oil companies, or in the case of all taxpayers in the olden days, as compared to those factors worldwide. We have now gone to water's edge for most taxpayers, but it used to be worldwide. Going back to the restaurant analogy, you can see that it doesn't matter whether you use separate accounting or a formula if everybody has about the same thing to eat. But it gets sticky if one person has a bowl of soup and somebody else eats a big steak. The three-factor formula assumes that profitability is fairly uniform throughout a business or a group of businesses. Neither formula apportionment nor separate accounting is perfect. They both have flaws, and both have been upheld by the courts. Most states and Alaska, originally, adopt the three-factor formula because it gets them out of the business of untangling corporate affairs and establishing transfer values. If a business, for example, manufactures in one state and sells in another, a value for the goods as they cross the state line has to be established, and this can be tricky. Tax authorities generally suspect that a business will tell State A all its profits are in State B, while they're telling State B that all their profits are earned in State A. When I was assigned to the separate accounting litigation in the 70s, I had the opportunity to review in some detail the written record of the legislature's four-year study of the corporate income tax as it applies to oil companies. More than 60-some hearings were held over that time period to reduce a four-year study to about 4 minutes. The legislature learned that there were flaws with each of the three factors used in the UDITPA formula as applied to an oil production company. The payroll factor is under state's income because oil production is not labor intensive, and it is largely conducted through the use of subcontractors. It was my understanding at that time that there were some federal income tax incentives to operate through subcontractors, but whether that's true or not, the fact is most of the business is done through subcontractors, and so the payroll factor is fairly low. The property factor is flawed luckily because traditional accounting methods and SEC rules do not recognize the value of the oil in the ground. Put another way, discovery is not an accounting event. Obviously, the reserves that an oil industry owns can be its greatest asset, but those reserves are not reflected on its books. When you use that understated property as compared to fully stated property like a refinery, you have the result of income sliding over to the jurisdiction with the better property formula. There was for a while a move to go to what was called reserve recognition accounting. The SEC floated that idea for a while, and as I understand it, it was unsuccessful. The sales factor is flawed because only a tiny fraction of the oil produced is sold in the state, and so the sales factor is not very good at attributing income. With none of the factors accurately representing an oil producer's actual business value, the legislature therefore went to the separate accounting method. In a nutshell, the law establishes value at the point of production by netting back the ultimate sales value to the wellhead by deducting out the transportation costs. That's done under both the production tax, well, for royalties, production tax, and income tax. In the late 70s and the early 80s, the value of ANS crude was not publicly available. It wasn't posted, and so there were huge discrepancies, disputes over this amount. The value at the point of production then was gross income from which are deducted the field costs or the cost of producing the oil. General overhead expenses under the old separate accounting law are apportioned. So the old law actually incorporated apportionment in two places. One was for general overhead joint expenses, and the other was, as you have just discussed, for other income that was not oil production or pipeline transportation income. The oil industry filed suit against the law, alleging that it violated the United States Constitution's Commerce Clause, Equal Protection Clause, and Contract Clause. They also alleged that it violated the state of Alaska's Equal Protection Law. It should be noted that while separate accounting was in effect, the price of oil went from about $8 a barrel to $31 a barrel, a huge increase in those days. So the revenue and the litigation risk piled up fairly fast. In 1981, when the law was repealed, it had collected about $2 billion. There was obviously political pressure from the industry to repeal the separate accounting law because it taxed so much revenue, and those who were around in those days might remember the coup in 1981, which many said pushed largely by the desire to repeal separate accounting. But there were also legal issues with the law at that time. In 1980, the United States Supreme Court had issued two opinions involving the division of corporate income for tax purposes. One was Exxon versus Wisconsin, and the other was Mobil versus Vermont. In both those cases, the state taxed the multi-state oil industry taxpayers using formula apportionment. The oil company taxpayers each argued that they could prove, by separate accounting or allocation, that they didn't earn that much money in their respective states. The Supreme Court, in upholding those state statutes, used some fairly strong language criticizing the flaws of separate accounting. This led some to conclude that apportionment was constitutionally required or that separate accounting was constitutionally prohibited. And that's largely what led to the litigation fear over the act. So I personally didn't put much credence in that theory, but it wasn't my $2 billion that was on the line. So separate accounting was repealed, and the state adopted what's now called modified apportionment for the industry. By the time the litigation reached the state Supreme Court, the Container Corporation decision had come down, which really resolved the litigation in the state's favor. The Container Corporation had very clear language that both separate accounting and apportionment were means to the same end, that they both had flaws, that they both had advantages, and that neither one of them was unconstitutional. So we were on firm ground. But in adopting the modified apportionment formula that we use today, the state was attempting to find and use apportionment factors that were better at actually at accurately apportioning production and pipeline transportation income than the old three-factor formula. The state adopted two different formulas. The production formula, production has a formula, two-factor formula that includes a property factor and an extraction factor. The property factor we talked about before, it still doesn't include the value of the reserves, but the extraction factor is the number of barrels extracted in your jurisdiction versus the number worldwide. For pipeline transportation, there's a two-factor formula that is, again, property, but the other factor is tariffs or sales. And it was my understanding when those two were adopted that production income would be taxed, would be apportioned by the two-factor formula and pipeline by the other two-factor formula. But right away, companies started using all three factors together for all of their income. And it's my understanding that that now is not just the practice, it's the law that the Attorney General's office has issued an opinion stating that's the correct way to do it. But the difficulty with that is that you have, you're using a tariff factor to apportion production income, which is pretty silly, and you're using an extraction factor to apportion pipeline transportation income, which is also pretty silly. So the result is the modified apportionment, as you have just heard, has never really worked very well. During my time with the state, the effective tax rate for oil and gas taxpayers was always somewhere around 3% rather than the 9.4% that's on the books. One fact that should be mentioned before I close is that while Alaska at one time used the so-called worldwide apportionment for all taxpayers, it abandoned that method years ago in favor of water's edge apportionment for everyone but the oil and gas industry. At the request of that industry, the modified apportionment stayed worldwide. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions if that's your pleasure.
Okay, questions from the committee for Ms. Vogt. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it Deborah?
Yes, ma'am.
Deborah, in your opinion, what would be the best thing for the state of Alaska to be doing?
Well, that's, you know, I really don't feel comfortable. I guess I have always felt that separate accounting more accurately identifies the oil industry income than any kind of apportionment formula that anybody has ever figured out. Whether that should be, you know, whether we should adopt it now or not, I really couldn't say.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, Ms. Vogt. Appreciate your testimony. This time, I'd like to ask you. You got a question for?
No, I had, but I was wondering if we could get Robin Wilson back on too.
Okay, Robin Wilson, you still there?
Yes, I am, Chairman.
I believe Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Thank you, Robin. And looking at the fiscal note, it's as I understand this, it doesn't have anything for 2013, 2014. It'd be about $253,000, and then it goes to a little over $500,000, and that's for four auditors plus some transportation and all. Is that correct? Is that the way I'm reading this?
Yes, Co-Chair Seaton, that is correct. Four auditors and transportation and some services.
And dealing with the Department of Revenue, would a $500,000 investment with a $250 million return annually, would that be a pretty good cost-benefit ratio?
Co-Chair Seaton, I can't really speak to the cost-benefit for that. As you've noted, we are working on some revised numbers, and I expect that will be forthcoming.
I guess all I was trying to figure out is that's quite a bit bigger return than we're getting on our investments in the permanent fund or Persian TERS. I mean, it seems like it's a very good utilization on the production from state employees. If it's four state employees and we estimate somewhere north of $100 million annually, that seems like that's very effective and efficient use of state personnel. So I guess that's not really a question for you, other than, yeah, no, that was my question.
I have one question.
Representative Munoz.
For Robin. Robin, how does separate accounting work when expenses associated with the product are occurring over more than one jurisdiction?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Munoz. I was not here during the administration of separate accounting. So in just looking at the bill as it's presented, it is not real clear how that works for multi-jurisdictional expenses, and I think that would show up particularly with administration expenses. It comes to mind immediately. If another state apportioned it, they would apportion the expenses as well as the income.
Representative Seed.
Thank you. And I guess that's not for Robin, but of course that's exactly what the courts looked at, mm-hmm. both the trial court and the Supreme Court, and the issue was also raised in the issue that was raised to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they determined that there were no significant issues. In fact, they determined at the Supreme Court level that separate accounting was probably more accurate than apportionment formulas, because apportionment formulas don't catch those things at all, and they determined that separate accounting was not taxing profits that were made in other jurisdictions, and all of the transportation to the market was allowed to be subtracted as a cost. So, but there was nothing on the end at the refineries, any profits made there that were collected back. But I guess I did have a question for Robin, Mr. Chairman, and that would be, have you gone or can you go back and pull up the regulations that were implemented for separate accounting and see if those are in place and if those can just be revitalized since they were obviously constructed for instituting that over a course of 4 years?
Yes, Co-Chair Seaton, we can look into the status of those regulations.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Mrs. Vogt or Ms. Vogt? All right, at this time I'd like to ask the sponsor to go back to the hot seat. Okay, obviously this bill would, if enacted, it would disallow the oil companies from being able to write off expenses incurred in other parts of the world. So they would be, and it would essentially, I believe, as you've shown, that it would result in increasing the corporate tax rate and hence the money that oil companies in Alaska would pay to the state of Alaska, correct?
Not exactly, Mr. Chairman. Okay. If the expenses were associated with production in Alaska, then they could be taken off of the corporate income tax. If they were unaffiliated, let's say they went over to Sakhalin Island or went someplace else and were drilling 50 wells there and had no production, so they had lots of expenses that were writing down their worldwide profits, and therefore we got less corporate income tax because they're deciding to invest elsewhere in the world, that would be where they wouldn't be able, with separate accounting, to deduct those expenses of investments overseas from their profits in Alaska.
Okay, then I guess we get back to the question that we've all been trying to answer for the last, at least the last year, is how does this put more oil into the taps?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it put more oil in taps because it does not incentivize companies to invest in other parts of the world. It incentivizes them to invest in Alaska, because any investment in Alaska is then an expense that reduces their profit here, and they don't pay that increased oil taxes. But it does not do what our current corporate income tax does, is incentivize them to take their money overseas instead of putting money into Alaska and increasing oil flow into taps.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Olson?
I just have a comment. So I would imagine that we would hear every single oil company not liking this bill.
through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know. I think that Alaskan oil companies will see it as fair. If they're paying 9.4% on all their profits in Alaska, and their competitors that are international and are paying less than their corporate income tax, I mean, do we want to put a disadvantage barrier on oil companies from being solely in Alaska and reinvesting here? I mean, I think that our whole goal for a number of years has been to incentivize companies to reinvest in Alaska, whether they're multinationals or not, and also to form oil companies here. I mean, I'm very happy that we have some small oil companies that are only located in Alaska, and I think it's unfair to say we're going to tax them at a higher rate because they're only in Alaska on the amount of profits they make than international oil companies that can dilute the profits they make here for tax purposes.
Any further questions from the committee? All right, hearing nothing. Let's see, where's my... Okay, on Friday we will hear House Bill 340, which is the Petersville Recreational Mining Area Land by Representative Newman. And we will continue with our board confirmation hearings. With
do you want to recognize that we have an ex-legislator in our office?
I could do that. I'd like to recognize we have ex-representative Norm Rokeberg. How you doing? And with that, the House Resources Committee will gavel out at, looks like, 3:48.